His store's in Jefferson now. She unbent without even getting out of the carriage, gracious and assured and talking the most complete nonsense, voluble, speaking her bright set meaningless phrases out of the part which she had written for herself, of the Duchess peripatetic with property soups and medicines among a soilless and uncompelled peasantry, a woman who, if she had had the fortitude to bear sorrow and trouble, might have risen to actual stardom in the role of the matriarch, arbitrating from the fireside corner of a crone the pride and destiny of her family, instead of turning at the last to the youngest member of it and asking her to protect the others. Often twice and sometimes three times a week the two of them came to town and into the house, the foolish, unreal, voluble, preserved woman now 6 years absent from the world, the woman who had quitted home and kin on a flood of tears, and in a shadowy, miasmic region something like the bitter purlieus of Styx had produced two children, and then rose like the swamp-hatched butterfly, unimpeded by weight of stomach and all the heavy organs of suffering and experience, into a perennial bright vacuum of arrested sun. And the young girl, dreamin', not livin', in her complete detachment and imperviousness to actuality, almost like physical deafness. To them, Miss Rosa must not have been anything at all now. Not the child who had been the object and victim of the vanished aunt's vindictive unflagging care and attention, and not even the woman which her office as housekeeper would indicate, and certainly not the factual aunt herself. And it would be hard to say which of the two, sister or niece, was the most unreal to Miss Rosa in turn. The adult who had escaped reality into a bland region peopled by dolls, or the young girl who slept waken in some suspension so completely physical as to resemble the state before birth and as far removed from reality's other extreme as Ellen was from hers, driving up to the house twice and three times a week, and one time in the summer when Judith was 17, stopping in on their way overland to Memphis to buy Judith clothes. Yes, trousseau. That was the summer following Henry's first year at the university, after he had brought Charles Bond home with him for Christmas, and then again to spend a week or so of the summer vacation before Bond rode on to the river to take the steamboat home to New Orleans. The summer in which Sutphen himself went away on business, Ellen said, told, doubtless unaware, such was her existence then, that she did not know where her husband had gone, and not even conscious that she was not curious. And no one but your grandfather and perhaps Clytie ever to know that Sutphen had gone to New Orleans, too. They would enter that dim, grim, tight little house where even yet, after 4 years, the aunt still seemed to be just beyond any door, with her hand already on the knob, and which Ellen would fill with 10 or 15 minutes of shrill uproar and then depart, taking with her the dreamy and volitionless daughter who had not spoken one word. And Miss Rosa, who in actual fact was the girl's aunt, and who by actual years should have been her sister, and who in actual experience and hope and opportunity should have been the niece, ignoring the mother to follow the departing and inaccessible daughter with myopic and inarticulate yearning, and not one whit of jealousy, projecting upon Judith all the abortive dreams and delusions of her own doomed and frustrated youth, offering Judith the only gift— it of necessity offered to the bride's equipment and not the bride, it was Ellen who told this, with shrieks of amusement more than once, in her power. She offered to teach Judith how to keep house and plan meals and count laundry, receiving for the offer the blank, fathomless stare, the unhearing, what did you say? While even now Ellen was shrieking with astonished appreciation. Then they were gone. Carriage, bundles, Ellen's peacock amusement, the niece's impenetrable dreamin'. When they came to town next and the carriage stopped before Mr. Coldfield's house, one of the negresses came out and said that Miss Rosa was not at home. That summer she saw Henry again, too. She had not seen him since the summer before, although he had been home Christmas with his friend from the university, and she had heard about the balls and parties at Sutphen's Hundred during the holidays, but she and her father had not gone out. And when Henry stopped with Bond on the way back to school the day after New Year's to speak to his aunt, she actually was not at home. So she did not see him until the following summer, after a full year. She was downtown, shopping. She was standing on the street talking to your grandmother when he rode past. He didn't see her. He passed on a new mare which his father had given him, in the coat and hat of a man now. Your grandmother said he was as tall as his father now, and that he sat the mare with the same swagger, although lighter in the bone than Sutphen, as if his bones were capable of bearing the swagger, but were still too light and quick to support the pomposity. Because Sutphen was acting his role, too. He had corrupted Ellen in more ways than one. He was the biggest single landowner and cotton planter in the county now, which state he had attained by the same tactics with which he had built his house. The same single-minded unflagging effort and utter disregard of how his actions which the town could see might look, and how the indicated ones which the town could not see must appear to it. That is, there were some among his fellow citizens who believed even yet that there was a nigger in the woodpile somewhere, ranging from the ones who believed that the plantation was just a blind to his actual dark avocation, through the ones who believed that he had found some way to juggle the cotton market itself, and so get more per bale for his cotton than honest men could, to the ones who believed, apparently, that the wild niggers which he had brought there had the power to actually conjure more cotton per acre from the soil than any tame ones had ever done. He was not liked, which he evidently did not want anyway, but feared, which seemed to amuse, if not actually please, him. But he was accepted. He obviously had too much money now to be rejected or even seriously annoyed any more. He accomplished this, got his plantation to running smoothly. He had an overseer now. It was the son of that same sheriff who had arrested him at his bride-to-be's gate on the day of the betrothal. Within 10 years of the wedding, and now he acted his role too. A role of arrogant ease and leisure, which, as the leisure and ease put flesh on him, became a little pompous. Yes, he had corrupted Ellen to more than renegadery, though, like her, unaware that his flowerin' was a forced bloomin' too, and that while he was still playing the scene to the audience, behind him fate, destiny, retribution, irony, the stage manager, call him what you will, was already striking the set and dragging on the synthetic and spurious shadows and shapes of the next one. "There goes," your grandmother said. But Miss Rosa had already seen him, standing there beside your grandmother, her head hardly reaching your grandmother's shoulder, thin, in one of the dresses which the aunt had left in the house and which Miss Rosa had cut down to fit herself, who had never been taught to sew either, just as she had assumed the housekeeping and offered to teach Judith to do the same, who had never been taught to cook nor taught to do anything save listen through closed doors, standing there with a shawl over her head like she might have been 50 instead of 15, looking after her nephew and saying, "Why, he's shaved." Then she stopped seeing Ellen even. That is, Ellen also stopped coming to the house, stopped breaking the carriage's weekly ritual of store to store, where, without getting out, Ellen bade merchant and clerk fetch out to her the cloth and the meager fripperies and baubles which they carried, and which they knew even better than she that she would not buy, but instead would merely finger and handle and disarrange and then reject, all in that flow of bright, pettish volubility. Not contemptuous, not even patronizing exactly, but with a bland and even childlike imposition upon the sufferance or good manners or sheer helplessness of the men, the merchants and clerks. Then to come to the house and fill it too with that meaningless uproar of vanity, of impossible and foundationless advice about Miss Rosa and her father and the house, about Miss Rosa's clothes and the arrangement of the furniture and the food and how prepared and even the hours at which eaten. Because the time now approached, it was 1860, even Mr. Coldfield probably admitted that war was unavoidable, when the destiny of Sutphen's family, which for 20 years now had been like a lake welling from quiet springs into a quiet valley, and spreading, rising almost imperceptibly, and in which the four members of it floated in sunny suspension, felt the first subterranean movement toward the outlet, the gorge which would be the land's catastrophe too, and the four peaceful swimmers turning suddenly to face one another, not yet with alarm or distrust, but just alert, feeling the dark set, none of them yet at that point where man looks about at his companions in disaster and thinks, When will I stop trying to save them and save only myself? And not even aware that that point was approaching. So Miss Rosa did not see any of them, who had never seen and was never to see alive Charles Bonn at all. Charles Bonn of New Orleans, Henry's friend, who was not only some few years older than Henry, but actually a little old to be still in college, and certainly a little out of place in that one where he was. A small new college in the Mississippi hinterland and even wilderness, 300 miles from that worldly and even foreign city which was his home. A young man of a worldly elegance and assurance beyond his years, handsome, apparently wealthy, and with for background the shadowy figure of a legal guardian rather than any parents, a personage who in the remote Mississippi of that time must have appeared almost phoenix-like, full-sprung from no childhood, born of no woman and impervious to time, and vanished, leaving no bones nor dust anywhere. A man with an ease of manner and a swagger and gallant air, in comparison with which Sutphen's pompous arrogance was clumsy bluff, and Henry actually a hobbledehoy. Miss Rosa never saw him. This was a picture, an image. It was not what Ellen told her, Ellen at the absolute halcyon of her butterfly's summer, and now with the added charm of gracious and graceful voluntary surrendering of youth to her blood's and sex's successor. That concurrent attitude and behavior, with the engagement's span, with which mothers who want to can almost make themselves the brides of their daughters' weddings. Listening to Ellen, a stranger would have almost believed that the marriage, which subsequent events would indicate had not even been mentioned between the young people and the parents, had been actually performed. Ellen did not once mention love between Judith and Bonn. She did not hint around at it. Love, with reference to them, was just a finished and perfectly dead subject like the matter of virginity would be after the birth of the first grandchild. She spoke of Bonn as if he were three inanimate objects in one, or perhaps one inanimate object for which she and her family would find three concordant uses. A garment which Judith might wear as she would a riding habit or a ball gown. A piece of furniture which would complement and complete the furnishing of her house and position. And a mentor and example to correct Henry's provincial manners and speech and clothing. She seemed to have encompassed time. She postulated the elapsed years during which no honeymoon nor any change had taken place, out of which the now five faces looked with a sort of lifeless and perennial bloom like painted portraits hung in a vacuum, each taken at its forewarned peak and smoothed of all thought and experience, the originals of which had lived and died so long ago that their joys and griefs must now be forgotten even by the very boards on which they had strutted and postured and laughed and wept. This, while Miss Rosa, not listening, who had got the picture from the first word, perhaps from the name Charles Bonn. The spinster doomed for life at 16, sitting beneath this bright glitter of delusion like it was one of those colored electric beams in cabarets, and she there for the first time in her life, and the beam filled with a substanceless glitter of tinsel motes darting suddenly upon her, halting for a moment, then going on. She wasn't jealous of Judith. It was not self-pity either, sitting there in one of those botched-over house dresses, the clothes cast off sometimes but usually new, which Ellen gave her from time to time, were always silk, of course, which the aunt had abandoned when she eloped with the horse and mule trader, perhaps in the hope or even the firm intention of never wearing such again, blinking steadily at her sister while Ellen talked. It was probably just peaceful despair and relief at final and complete abnegation, now that Judith was about to immolate the frustration's vicarious recompense into the living fairy tale. It sounded like a fairy tale when Ellen told it later to your grandmother. Only it was a fairy tale written for and acted by a fashionable ladies' club. But to Miss Rosa it must have been authentic, not only plausible but justified. Hence the remark which sent Ellen again, she told this too for the childish joke it was, into shrieks of amused and fretted astonishment. "We deserve him," Miss Rosa said. "Deserve him?" Ellen said, probably shrieked too. "Of course we deserve him, if you want to put it that way. I certainly hope and expect you to feel that the Coldfields are qualified to reciprocate whatever particularly signal honor marriage with anyone might confer upon them. Naturally, there is no known rejoinder to this. At least, as far as Ellen ever told, Miss Rosa did not try to make one. She just saw Ellen depart and then set about to make Judith the second only gift in her power. She possessed two now, this one likewise bequeathed to her by the aunt who taught her both to keep house and how to fit clothes by climbing out a window one night. Though this second gift developed late, you might say repercussed, due to the fact that when the aunt left, Miss Rosa was not yet large enough to be able to use the discarded clothing even by cutting the garments down. She set about secretly making garments for Judith's trousseau. She got the cloth from her father's store. She could not have got it anywhere else. Your grandmother told me that at that time Miss Rosa actually could not count money, change, that she knew the progression of the coins in theory, but that apparently she had never had the actual cash to see, touch, experiment, and prove with. That on certain days of the week she would go downtown with a basket and shop at certain stores which Mr. Coldfield had already designated, with no coin nor sum of money change in lip or hand, and that later in the day Mr. Coldfield would trace her course by the debits scratched on paper or on walls and counters and pay them. So she would have to get the material from him. And as he had brought his entire business to Jefferson in one wagon, and this at a time when he had mother, sister, wife, and children to support out of it, as against now when he had but one child to support out of it, and weighed along with this that profound disinterest in material accumulation which had permitted conscience to cause him to withdraw from that old affair in which his son-in-law had involved him, not only at the cost of his just profits, but at the sacrifice of his original investment. His stock, which had begun as a collection of the crudest necessities and which apparently could not even feed himself and his daughter from its own shelves, had not increased, let alone diversified. Yet this was where she had to go to get the material to make those intimate young girl garments which were to be for her own vicarious bridal. And you can imagine, too, what Miss Rosa's notion of such garments would be, let alone what her notion of them would look like when she had finished them unassisted. Nobody knows how she managed to get the material from her father's store. He didn't give it to her. He would have felt it incumbent on him to supply his granddaughter with clothes if she were indecently clad, or if she were ragged or cold, but not to marry in. So I believe she stole it. She must have. She must have taken it almost from under her father's nose. It was a small store, and he was his own clerk, and from any point in it he could see any other point. With that amoral boldness, that affinity for brigandage of women. But more likely, also, I would like to think, by some subterfuge of such bald and desperate transparence concocted by innocence that its very simplicity fooled him. So she didn't even see Ellen any more. Apparently Ellen had now served her purpose, completed the bright pointless noon and afternoon of the butterfly's summer, and vanished. Perhaps not out of Jefferson, but out of her sister's life, anyway. To be seen but the one time more, dying in bed in a darkened room in the house on which fateful mischance had already laid its hand, to the extent of scattering the black foundation on which it had been erected, and removing its two male mainstays, husband and son. The one into the risk and danger of battle, the other apparently into oblivion. Henry had just vanished. She heard of that, too, while she was spending her days and nights she would have to wait until her father was asleep, sewing tediously and without skill on the garments which she was making for her niece's trousseau, and which she had to keep hidden not only from her father but from the two negresses, who might have told Mr. Coldfield. Whipping lace out of raveled and hoarded string and thread and sewing it onto garments while news came of Lincoln's election and the fall of Sumter, and she scarce listening. Hearing and losing the knell and doom of her native land between two tedious and clumsy stitches on a garment which she would never wear and never remove for a man whom she was not even to see alive. Henry just vanished. She heard just what the town heard. That on this next Christmas Henry and Bond came home again to spend the holidays, the handsome and wealthy New Orleansian whose engagement to the daughter the mother had been filling the town's ears with for 6 months now. They came again, and now the town listened for the announcement of the actual day. And then something happened. Nobody knew what, whether something between Henry and Bon on one hand and Judith on the other, or between the three young people on one hand and the parents on the other. But anyway, when Christmas Day came, Henry and Bon were gone, and Ellen was not visible. She seemed to have retired to the darkened room, which she was not to quit until she died 2 years later. And nobody could have told from either Sutphen's or Judith's faces or actions or behavior. And so the tale came through the negroes, of how on the night before Christmas there had been a quarrel between not Bon and Henry or Bon and Sutphen, but between the son and the father, and that Henry had formally abjured his father and renounced his birthright and the roof under which he had been born, and that he and Bon had ridden away in the night, and that the mother was prostrate, though the town believed not at the upset of the marriage, but at the shock of reality entering her life. This the merciful blow of the axe before the beast's throat is cut, though Ellen, of course, did not know this either. That's what Miss Rosa heard. Nobody knows what she thought. The town believed that Henry's action was just the fiery nature of youth, let alone a Sutphen, and that time would cure it. Doubtless Sutphen's and Judith's behavior toward one another and toward the town had something to do with this. They would be seen together in the carriage in town now and then, as though nothing had occurred between them at least, which certainly would not have been the case if the quarrel had been between Bon and the father, and probably not the case if the trouble had been between Henry and his father, because the town knew that between Henry and Judith there had been a relationship closer than the traditional loyalty of brother and sister even. A curious relationship. Something of that fierce, impersonal rivalry between two cadets in a crack regiment who eat from the same dish and sleep under the same blanket and chance the same destruction, and who would risk death for one another, not for the other's sake, but for the sake of the unbroken front of the regiment itself. That's all Miss Rosa knew. She could have known no more about it than the town knew, because the ones who did know, Sutphen or Judith, not Ellen, who would have been told nothing in the first place and would have forgot, failed to assimilate it if she had been. Ellen the butterfly, from beneath whom without warning the very sun-buoyed air had been withdrawn, leaving her now with the plump hands folded on the coverlet in the darkened room, and the eyes above them probably not even suffering but merely filled with baffled incomprehension, would not have told her any more than they would have told anyone in Jefferson or anywhere else. She probably went out there, probably once and then no more, and doubtless she did not ask, not even Judith, perhaps knowing she would not be told, or perhaps because she was waiting. And she must have told Mr. Coldfield that there was nothing wrong, and evidently she believed that herself, since she continued to sew on the garments for Judith's wedding. She was still doing that when Mississippi seceded, and when the first Confederate uniforms began to appear in Jefferson, where Colonel Sartoris and Sutphen were raising the regiment which departed in 61, with Sutphen, second in command, riding at Colonel Sartoris's left hand, on the black stallion named out of Scott, beneath the regimental colors which he and Sartoris had designed, and which Sartoris's women folks had sewed together out of silk dresses. He had filled out physically from what he had been not only when he first rode into Jefferson that Sunday in 33, but from what he had been when he and Ellen married. He was not portly yet, though he was now getting on toward 55. The fat, the stomach, came later. It came upon him suddenly, all at once, in the year after whatever it was happened to his engagement to Miss Rosa, and she quitted his roof and returned to town to live alone in her father's house and did not ever speak to him again except when she addressed him that one time when they told her that he was dead. The flesh came upon him suddenly, as though what the negroes and Wash Jones, too, called the fine figure of a man, had reached and held its peak after the foundation had given away, and something between the shape of him that people knew and the uncompromising skeleton of what he actually was had gone fluid, and, earthbound, had been snubbed up and restrained, balloon-like, unstable, and lifeless, by the envelope which it had betrayed. She did not see the regiment depart, because her father forbade her to leave the house until it was gone, refusing to allow her to take part in or be present with the other women and girls in the ceremony of its departure, though not because his son-in-law happened to be in it. He had never been an irascible man, and before war was actually declared and Mississippi seceded, his acts and speeches of protest had been not only calm but logical and quite sensible. But after the die was cast, he seemed to change overnight, just as his daughter Ellen changed her nature a few years before. As soon as troops began to appear in Jefferson, he closed his store and kept it closed all during the period that soldiers were being mobilized and drilled. Not only then, but later, after the regiment was gone, whenever casual troops would bivouac for the night in passing, refusing to sell any goods for any price, not only to the military, but, so it was told, to the families not only of soldiers, but of men or women who had supported secession and war only in talk, opinion. Not only did he refuse to permit his sister to come back home to live while her horse trader husband was in the army, he would not even allow Miss Rosa to look out the window at passing soldiers. He had closed his store permanently and was at home all day now. He and Miss Rosa lived in the back of the house, with the front door locked and the front shutters closed and fastened, where, so the neighbors said, he spent the day behind one of the slightly opened blinds like a picket on post, armed not with a musket but with the big family Bible, in which his and his sister's birth and his marriage, and Ellen's birth and marriage, and the birth of his two grandchildren and of Miss Rosa, and his wife's death, but not the marriage of the aunt, it was Miss Rosa who entered that, along with Ellen's death on the day when she entered Mr. Coldfield's own and Charles Bond's and even Sutpen's, had been duly entered in his neat clerk's hand, until a detachment of troops would pass, whereupon he would open the Bible and declaim in a harsh, loud voice, even above the sound of the tramping feet, the passages of the old violent vindictive mysticism which he had already marked as the actual picket would have ranged his row of cartridges along the windowsill. Then one morning he learned that his store had been broken into and looted, doubtless by a company of strange troops, bivouacked on the edge of town, and doubtless abetted, if only vocally, by his own fellow citizens. That night he mounted to the attic with his hammer and his handful of nails and nailed the door behind him and threw the hammer out the window. He was not a coward. He was a man of uncompromising moral strength. Coming into a new country with a small stock of goods and supporting 5 people out of it in comfort and security, at least. He did it by close trading, to be sure. He could not have done it save by close trading or dishonesty. And as your grandfather said, a man who, in a country such as Mississippi was then, would restrict dishonesty to the selling of straw hats and hamstrings and salt meat would have been already locked up by his own family as a kleptomaniac. But he was not a coward, even though his conscience may have objected, as your grandfather said, not so much to the idea of pouring out human blood and life, but at the idea of waste, of wearing out and eating up and shooting away material, in any cause whatever. Now Miss Rosa's life consisted of keeping it in herself and her father. Up to the night of the looting of the store, they had lived out of it. She would go to the store after dark with a basket and fetch back enough food to last for a day or two. So the stock, not renewed for some time before that, was considerably reduced even before the looting. And soon she, who had never been taught to do anything practical because the aunt had raised her to believe that she was not only delicate but actually precious, was cooking the food, which as time passed became harder and harder to come by and poorer in quality, and hauling it up to her father at night by means of a well pulley and rope attached to the attic window. She did this for 3 years, feeding in secret and at night and with food which in quantity was scarcely sufficient for one, the man whom she hated. And she may not have known before that she hated him, and she may not have known it now, even. Nevertheless, the first of the odes to Southern soldiers in that portfolio, which, when your grandfather saw it in 1885, contained 1,000 or more, was dated in the first year of her father's voluntary incarceration, and dated at 2 o'clock in the morning. Then he died. One morning the hand did not come out to draw up the basket. The old nails were still in the door, and neighbors helped her break it in with axes, and they found him, who had seen his sole means of support looted by the defenders of his cause, even if he had repudiated it and them, with 3 days uneaten food beside his pallet bed, as if he had spent the 3 days in a mental balancing of his terrestrial accounts, found the result and proved it, and then turned upon his contemporary scene of folly and outrage and injustice the dead and consistent impassivity of a cold and inflexible disapproval. Now Miss Rosa was not only an orphan, but a pauper, too. The store was now just a shell, the deserted building vacated even by rats and containing nothing, not even goodwill, since he had irrevocably estranged himself from neighbors, town, and embattled land, all three, by his behavior. Even the two negresses, which he had freed as soon as he came into possession of them, through a debt, by the way, not purchase, writing out their papers of freedom which they could not read and putting them on a weekly wage which he held back in full against the discharge of the current market value at which he had assumed them on the debt, and in return for which they had been among the first Jefferson Negroes to desert and follow the Yankee troops, were gone now. So when he died he had nothing, not only saved but kept. Doubtless the only pleasure which he had ever had was not in the meager Spartan hoard which he had accumulated before his path crossed that of his future son-in-law. Not in the money, but in its representation of a balance in whatever spiritual counting house he believed would some day pay his sight drafts on self-denial and fortitude. And doubtless what hurt him most in the whole business with Sutphen was not the loss of the money, but the fact that he had had to sacrifice the hoarding, the symbol of the fortitude and abnegation, to keep intact the spiritual solvency which he believed that he had already established and secured. It was as if he had had to pay the same note twice because of some trifling oversight of date or signature. So Miss Rosa was both pauper and orphan, with no kin above dust but Judith and the aunt who had been last heard of 2 years ago while trying to pass the Yankee lines to reach Illinois, and so be near the Rock Island prison where her husband, who had offered his talents for horse and mule getting to the Confederate Cavalry Remount Corps, and had been caught at it, now was. Ellen was dead 2 years now, the butterfly, the moth, caught in a gale and blown against a wall and clinging there, beaten feebly, not with any particular stubborn clinging to life, not in particular pain, since it was too light to have struck hard, nor even with very much remembrance of the bright vacuum before the gale, but just in bewildered and uncomprehending amazement. The bright trivial shell not even to any great extent changed, despite the year of bad food, since all of Sutphen's negroes had deserted also to follow the Yankee troops away. The wild blood which he had brought into the country and tried to mix, blend, with the tame which was already there, with the same care and for the same purpose with which he blended that of the stallion and that of his own, and with the same success, as though his presence alone compelled that house to accept and retain human life, as though houses actually possess a sentience, a personality and character, acquired not from the people who breathe or have breathed in them, so much as rather inherent in the wood and brick, or begotten upon the wooden brick by the man or men who conceived and built them. In this one, an incontrovertible affirmation for emptiness, desertion, an insurmountable resistance to occupancy, save when sanctioned and protected by the ruthless and the strong. She had lost some flesh, of course, but it was as the butterfly itself enters dissolution by actually dissolving, the area of wing and body decreasing a little, the pattern of the spots drawn a little closer together, but with no wrinkle to show, the same smooth, almost girlish face on the pillow, though Miss Rosa now discovered that Ellen had been dyeing her hair evidently for years, the same almost plump, soft, though now unringed hands on the coverlet, and only the bafflement in the dark, uncomprehending eyes to indicate anything of present life by which to postulate approaching death, as she asked the 17-year-old sister, Henry up to now has just vanished, his birthright voluntarily repudiated, he had not yet returned to play his final part in his family's doom, and this your grandfather said spared Ellen too, not that it would have been the crushing and crowning blow, but that it would have been wasted on her, since the clinging moth, even alive, would have been incapable now of feeling any more of wind or violence, to protect the remaining child. So the natural thing would have been for her to go out and live with Judith, the natural thing for her or any Southern woman, gentlewoman. She would not have needed to be asked. No one would expect her to wait to be, because that's what a Southern lady is. Not the fact that penniless and with no prospect of ever being otherwise, and knowing that all who know her know this, yet moving with a parasol and a private chamber pot and three trunks into your home and into the room where your wife uses the hand-embroidered linen, and not only takes command of all the servants who likewise know that she will never tip them because they know as well as the white folks that she will never have anything to tip them with, but goes into a kitchen and dispossesses the cook and seasons the very food you are going to eat to suit her own palate. It's not this that she is dependent on to keep body and soul together. It is as though she were living on the actual blood itself like a vampire, not with insatiability, certainly not with voracity, but with that serene and idle splendor of flowers arrogating to herself, because it fills her veins also, nourishment from the old blood that crossed uncharted seas and continents and battled wilderness hardships and lurking circumstances and fatalities, with tranquil disregard of whatever onerous cocks to leisure and even peace, which the preservation of it incurs upon what might be called the contemporary transmutable fountainhead, who contrives to keep the crass, food-barren corpuscles sufficiently numerous and healthy in the stream. That's what she would have been expected to do, but she didn't. Though Judith was an orphan too, yet Judith still had those abandoned acres to draw from, let alone Clytie to help her, keep her company, and Wash Jones to feed her as Wash had fed Ellen before she died. But Miss Rosa didn't go out there at once. Perhaps she never would have gone, although Ellen had asked her to protect Judith. Possibly she felt that Judith did not need protection yet, since if even deferred love could have supplied her with the will to exist, endure for this long, then that same love, even though deferred, must and would preserve bond until the folly of men would stalemate from sheer exhaustion, and he would return from wherever he was and bring Henry with him, Henry victim too of the same folly and mischance. She must have seen Judith now and then, and Judith probably urged her to come out to Sutpen's Hundred to live. But I believe that this is the reason she did not go, even though she did not know where Bon and Henry were, and Judith apparently never thought to tell her. Because Judith knew. She may have known for some time. Even Ellen may have known, only probably to Ellen at that time absence was not a qualitative state, absence into ignominy or into oblivion being identical, and so it may not have occurred to Ellen either to tell her sister that to another the uncertainty of battle and the certainty of oblivion might be two things. Or perhaps Judith never told her mother either. Perhaps Ellen did not know before she died that Henry and Bond were now privates in the company which their classmates at the university had organized. Miss Rosa did not know it at all. The first intimation she had had in 4 years that her nephew was still alive was the afternoon when Wash Jones, riding Sutpen's remaining mule, stopped in front of the house and began to shout her name. She had seen him before, but she did not recognize him. A gaunt, gangling man, malaria-ridden with pale eyes and a face that might have been any age between 25 and 60, sitting on the saddleless mule in the street before the gate, shouting, "Hello! Hello!" at intervals until she came to the door. Whereupon he lowered his voice somewhat, though not very much. "Air you Rosie Coldfield?" he said. Chapter 4. It was still not dark enough for Quentin to start, not yet dark enough to suit Miss Coldfield, at least, even discounting the 12 miles out there and the 12 miles back. Quentin knew that. He could almost see her, waiting in one of the dark, airless rooms in the little grim house's impregnable solitude. She would have no light burning because she would be out of the house soon, and probably some mental descendant or kinsman of him or her who had told her once that light and moving air carried heat had also told her that the cost of electricity was not in the actual time the light burned, but in the retroactive overcoming of primary inertia when the switch was snapped. That was what showed on the meter. She would be wearing already the black bonnet with jet sequins, he knew that, and a shawl, sitting there in the augmenting and defunctive twilight. She would have even now in her hand or on her lap the reticule with all the keys, entrance closet, and cupboard that the house possessed, which she was about to desert for perhaps 6 hours, and a parasol, an umbrella, too, he thought, thinking how she would be impervious to weather and season, since although he had not spoken 100 words to her in his life before this afternoon, he did know that she had never before tonight quitted that house after sundown, save on Sundays and Wednesdays for prayer meeting, in the entire 43 years, probably. Yes, she would have the umbrella. She would emerge with it when he called for her, and carry it invincibly into the spent suspiration of an evening without even dew, where even now the only alteration toward darkness was in the soft and fuller random of the fireflies. A fuller and more profound random in the twilight following 60 days without rain and 42 without even dew. Below the gallery, where he rose from his chair as Mr. Compson, carrying the letter, emerged from the house, snapping on the porch light as he passed. "You will probably have to go inside to read it," Mr. Compson said. "Maybe I can read it here all right," Quentin said. "Perhaps you are right," Mr. Compson said. "Maybe even the light of day, let alone this." He indicated the single globe stained and bug-fouled from the long summer and which even when clean gave off but little light. "Which man had to invent to his need, since, relieved of the onus of sweatin' to live, he is apparently revertin' or evolvin' back into a nocturnal animal, would be too much for it, for them. Yes, for them. Of that day and time, of a dead time, people too as we are, and victims too as we are, but victims of a different circumstance, simpler, and therefore, integer for integer, larger, more heroic. And the figures therefore more heroic too, not dwarfed and involved, but distinct, uncomplex, who had the gift of loving once or dying once, instead of being diffused and scattered creatures drawn blindly limb from limb from a grab bag and assembled. Author and victim too of 1,000 homicides and 1,000 copulations and divorcements. Perhaps you are right. Perhaps any more light than this would be too much for it. But he did not give Quentin the letter at once. He sat again, Quentin sitting again too, and took up the cigar from the veranda rail, the coal glowing again, the wisteria-colored smoke drifting again unwinded across Quentin's face, as Mr. Compson raised his feet once more to the railing, the letter in his hand, and the hand looking almost as dark as a negro's against his linen leg. Because Henry loved Barn, he repudiated blood birthright and material security for his sake, for the sake of this man who was at least an intended bigamist, even if not an out-and-out blackguard, and on whose dead body 4 years later Judith was to find the photograph of the other woman and the child. So much so that he, Henry, could give his father the lie about a statement which he must have realized that his father could not and would not have made without foundation and proof. Yet he did it, Henry himself striking the blow with his own hand, even though he must have known that what his father told him about the woman and the child was true. He must have said to himself, must have said when he closed the library door for the last time behind himself that Christmas Eve, and must have repeated while he and Bond rode side by side through the iron dark of that Christmas morning, away from the house where he had been born, and which he would see but one time more, and that with the fresh blood of the man who now rode beside him on his hands. I will believe, I will, even if it is so, even if what my father told me is true, and which, in spite of myself, I cannot keep from knowing is true, I will still believe. Because what else could he have hoped to find in New Orleans, if not the truth, if not what his father had told him, what he had denied and refused to accept, even though, despite himself, he must have already believed? But who knows why a man, though suffering, clings above all the other well members to the arm or leg which he knows must come off? Because he loved Barn. I can imagine him and Sutphen in the library that Christmas Eve, the father and the brother, percussion and repercussion like a thunderclap and its echo, and as close. The statement and the given of the lie, the decision instantaneous and irrevocable between father and friend, between, so Henry must have believed, that where honor and love lay and this where blood and profit ran, even though at the instant of given the lie he knew that it was the truth. That was why the 4 years, the probation. He must have known that it would be vain, even then, on that Christmas Eve, not to speak of what he learned, saw with his own eyes in New Orleans. He may even have known Bond that well by then, who had not changed until then, and so would in all probability not change later. And he, Henry, who could not say to his friend, "I did that for love of you, do this for love of me." He couldn't say that, you see. This man, this youth, scarcely 20, who had turned his back upon all that he knew, to cast his lot with the single friend whom, even as they rode away that night, he must have known, as he knew that what his father had told him was true, that he was doomed and destined to kill. He must have known that just as he knew that his hope was vain. What hope and what for, he could not have said. What hope and dream of change in Bond or in the situation? What dream that he could some day wake from and find it had been a dream? As in the injured man's fever dream, the dear suffering arm or leg is strong and sound, and only the well ones sick. It was Henry's probation, Henry holding all three of them in that durance to which even Judith acquiesced up to a certain point. She did not know what happened in the library that night. I don't think she ever did, suspected, until that afternoon 4 years later when she saw them again, when they brought Bond's body into the house and she found in his coat the photograph which was not her face, not her child. She just waked the next morning and they were gone, and only the letter, the note, remaining. The note written by Henry, since doubtless he refused to allow Bond to write. This announcement of the armistice, the probation, and Judith acquiescing up to that point, who would have refused as quickly to obey any injunction of her father as Henry had been to defy him, yet who did obey Henry in this matter, not the male relative, the brother, but because of that relationship between them, that single personality with two bodies, both of which had been seduced almost simultaneously by a man whom at the time Judith had never even seen. She and Henry both knowing that she would observe the probation, give him, Henry, the benefit of that interval, only up to that mutually recognized, though unstated and undefined point, and both doubtless aware that when that point was reached, she would, and with the same calm, the same refusal to accept or give because of any traditional weakness of sex, recall the armistice and face him as a foe. Not requiring or even wishing that Bond be present to support her, doubtless even refusing to allow him to intervene if he were. Fighting the matter out with Henry like a man first before consenting to revert to the woman, the loved, the bride. And Bond. Henry would have no more told Bond what his father had told him than he would have returned to his father and told him that Bond denied it. Since to do one, he would have to do the other, and he knew that Bond's denial would be a lie. And though he could have borne Bond's lie himself, he could not have borne for either Judith or his father to hear it. Besides, Henry would not need to tell Bond what had happened. Bond must have learned of Sutphen's visit to New Orleans as soon as he, Bond, reached home that first summer. He must have known that Sutphen now knew his secret. If Bond, until he saw Sutphen's reaction to it, ever looked upon it as a cause for secrecy, certainly not as a valid objection to marriage with a white woman, a situation in which probably all his contemporaries who could afford it were likewise involved, and which it would no more have occurred to him to mention to his bride or wife or to her family than he would have told them the secrets of a fraternal organization which he had joined before he married. In fact, the manner in which his intended bride's family reacted to the discovery of it was doubtless the first and last time when the Sutphen family ever surprised him. He is the curious one to me. He came into that isolated Puritan country household almost like Sutphen himself came into Jefferson. Apparently complete, without background or past or childhood. A man a little older than his actual years and enclosed and surrounded by a sort of Scythian glitter, who seems to have seduced the country brother and sister without any effort or particular desire to do so, who caused all the pother and uproar, yet from the moment when he realized that Sutphen was going to prevent the marriage if he could, he, Bond, seems to have withdrawn into a mere spectator, passive, a little sardonic, and completely enigmatic. He seems to hover, shadowy, almost substanceless, a little behind and above all the other straightforward and logical, even though to him incomprehensible ultimatums and affirmations and defiances and challenges and repudiations, with an air of sardonic and indolent detachment, like that of a youthful Roman consul making the grand tour of his day among the barbarian hordes which his grandfather conquered, benighted in a brawling and childish and quite deadly mud castle household in a miasmic and spirit-ridden forest. It was as if he found the whole business, not inexplicable, of course, just unnecessary, that he knew at once that Sutpen had found out about the mistress and child, and he now found Sutpen's action and Henry's reaction a fetish-ridden moral blunderin' which did not deserve to be called thinkin', which he contemplated with the detached attentiveness of a scientist watching the muscles in an anesthetized frog, watching, contemplating them from behind that barrier of sophistication in comparison with which Henry and Sutpen were troglodytes. Not just the outside, the way he walked and talked and wore his clothes and handed Ellen into the dining room or into the carriage, and perhaps, probably, kissed her hand, and which Ellen envied for Henry, but the man himself, that fatalistic and impenetrable imperturbability with which he watched them while he waited for them to do whatever it would be that they would do, as if he had known all the while that the occasion would arise when he would have to wait, and that all he would need to do would be to wait. That he had seduced Henry and Judith both too thoroughly to have any fear that he might not marry Judith when he wished to. Not that stupid shrewdness, half instinct and half belief in luck, and half muscular habit of the senses and nerves of the gambler waiting to take what he can from what he sees, but a certain reserved and inflexible pessimism, stripped long generations ago of all the rubbish and claptrap of people—yes, Sutpen and Henry and the Coldfields, too—who have not quite yet emerged from barbarism, who 2,000 years hence will still be throwing triumphantly off the yoke of Latin culture and intelligence, of which they were never in any great permanent danger to begin with. Because he loved Judith— He would have added, doubtless, after his fashion, since, as his intended father-in-law soon learned, this was not the first time he had played this part, pledged what he had pledged to Judith, let alone the first time he would have gone through a ceremony to commemorate it. Make what distinction? He was a Catholic of sorts. He might, between this one with a white woman and that other. Because you will see the letter, not the first one he ever wrote to her, but at least the first, the only one she ever showed, as your grandmother knew then. And so we believe, now that she is dead, the only one which she kept, unless, of course, Miss Rosa or Clytie destroyed the others after she herself died. And this one here preserved not because Judith put it away to keep, but because she brought it herself and gave it to your grandmother after Bond's death. Possibly on the same day when she destroyed the others which he had written her, provided, of course, it was she herself who destroyed them, which would have been when she found in Bond's coat the picture of the octoroon mistress and the little boy, because he was her first and last sweetheart. She must have seen him, in fact, with exactly the same eyes that Henry saw him with, and it would be hard to say to which of them he appeared the most splendid, to the one with hope, even though unconscious of making the image hers through possession, to the other with the knowledge, even though subconscious to the desire, of the insurmountable barrier which the similarity of gender hopelessly intervened. This man whom Henry first saw riding, perhaps through the grove at the university on one of the two horses which he kept there, or perhaps crossing the campus on foot in the slightly Frenchified cloak and hat which he wore, or perhaps, I like to think this, presented formally to the man reclining in a flowered, almost feminized gown, in a sunny window in his chambers. This man handsome, elegant, and even cat-like, and too old to be where he was, too old not in years but in experience, with some tangible effluvium of knowledge, surfeit, of actions done and satiations plumbed and pleasures exhausted and even forgotten. So that he must have appeared, not only to Henry but to the entire undergraduate body of that small new provincial college, as a source not of envy, because you only envy whom you believe to be, but for accident, in no way superior to yourself, and what you believe, granted a little better luck than you have had heretofore, you will some day possess. Not of envy, but of despair, that sharp, shocking, terrible, hopeless despair of the young, which sometimes takes the form of insult toward, and even physical assault upon, the human subject of it, or, in extreme cases like Henry's, insult toward and assault upon any and all detractors of the subject, as witness Henry's violent repudiation of his father and his birthright when Sutpan forbade the marriage. Yes, he loved Bon, who seduced him as surely as he seduced Judith. The country boy, born and bred, who, with the 5 or 6 others of that small undergraduate body composed of other planters' sons, whom Bond permitted to become intimate with him, who aped his clothing and manner, and, to the extent which they were able, his very manner of living, looked upon Bond as though he were a hero out of some adolescent Arabian Nights, who had stumbled upon, or rather had thrust upon him, a talisman or touchstone, not to invest him with wisdom or power or wealth, but with the ability and opportunity to pass from the scene of one scarce imaginable delight to the next one without interval or pause or satiety. And the very fact that, lounging before them in the outlandish and almost feminine garments of his sybaritic privacy, he professed satiety, but increased not only the amazement but the bitter and hopeless outrage. Henry, the provincial, the clown almost, given to instinctive and violent action rather than to thinking, ratiocination, who may have been conscious that his fierce provincial's pride in his sister's virginity was a false quantity which must incorporate in itself an inability to endure in order to be precious, to exist, and so must depend upon its loss, absence, to have existed at all. In fact, perhaps this is the pure and perfect incest, the brother realizing that the sister's virginity must be destroyed in order to have existed at all, taking that virginity in the person of the brother-in-law, the man whom he would be if he could become, metamorphose into, the lover, the husband, by whom he would be despoiled, choose for despoiler, if he could become, metamorphose into the sister, the mistress, the bride. Perhaps that is what went on, not in Henry's mind, but in his soul, because he never thought. He felt and acted immediately. He knew loyalty and acted it. He knew pride and jealousy. He loved, grieved, and killed, still grieving and, I believe, still loving Bond, the man to whom he gave 4 years of probation, 4 years in which to renounce and dissolve the other marriage, knowing that the 4 years of hoping and waiting would be in vain. Yes, Henry, not Bond, as witnessed the entire queerly placid course of Bond's and Judith's courtship, an engagement, if engagement it ever was, lasting for a whole year, yet comprising 2 holiday visits as her brother's guest, and which periods Bond seems to have spent either in riding and hunting with Henry, or as acting as an elegant and indolent esoteric hothouse bloom, possessing merely the name of a city for origin, history, and past, about which Ellen preened and fluttered out her unwitting butterflies Indian summer. He, the living man, was usurped, you see. There was no time, no interval, no niche in the crowded days when he could have courted Judith. You cannot even imagine him and Judith alone together. Try to do it, and the nearest you can come is a projection of them while the 2 actual people were doubtless separate and elsewhere. 2 shades pacing, serene and untroubled by flesh in a summer garden. The same 2 serene phantoms who seemed to watch, hover, impartial, attentive, and quiet, above and behind the inexplicable thunderhead of interdictions and defiances and repudiations, out of which the rock-like Sutpan and the volatile and violent Henry flashed and glared and ceased. Henry, who up to that time had never even been to Memphis, who had never been away from home before that September when he went to the university with his countrified clothes and his saddle horse and negro groom. The 6 or 7 of them, of an age and background, only in the surface matter of food and clothing and daily occupation, any different from the negro slaves who supported them. The same sweat. The only difference being that on the one hand it went for labor in fields, where on the other it went as the price of the spartan and meager pleasures which were available to them because they did not have to sweat in the fields. The hard, violent hunting and riding. The same pleasures. The one, gambling for worn knives and brass jewelry and twists of tobacco and buttons and garments, because they happened to be easiest and quickest to hand. On the other, for the money and horses, the guns and watches, and for the same reason. The same parties, the identical music from identical instruments, crude fiddles and guitars, now in the big house with candles and silk dresses and champagne, now in the dirt-floored cabins with smoke and pine knots and calico and water sweetened with molasses. It was Henry, because at that time Bon had not even seen Judith. He had probably not paid enough attention to Henry's inarticulate recounting of his brief and conventional background and history to have remembered that Henry had a sister. This indolent man, too old to find even companionship among the youths, the children, with whom he now lived. This man miscast for the time and knowing it, accepting it for a reason obviously good enough to cause him to endure it and apparently too serious or at least too private to be divulged to what acquaintances he now possessed. This man who later showed the same indolence, almost uninterest, the same detachment when the uproar about that engagement which, so far as Jefferson knew, never formally existed, which Bon himself never affirmed or denied, arose, and he in the background, impartial and passive, as though it were not himself involved, or he acting on behalf of some absent friend, but as though the person involved and interdict were someone whom he had never heard of and cared nothing about. There does not even seem to have been any courtship. Apparently he paid Judith the dubious compliment of not even trying to ruin her, let alone insisting on the marriage either before or after Sutphen forbade it. This, mind you, in a man who had already acquired a name for prowess among women while at the university, long before Sutphen was to find actual proof. No engagement, no courtship even. He and Judith saw one another 3 times in 2 years for a total period of 12 days, counting the time Ellen consumed. They parted without even saying goodbye. And yet 4 years later Henry had to kill Bond to keep them from marrying. So it must have been Henry who seduced Judith, not Bon. Seduced her along with himself from that distance between Oxford and Sutphen's Hundred, between herself and the man whom she had not even seen yet. As though by means of that telepathy with which as children they seemed at times to anticipate one another's actions as 2 birds leave a limb at the same instant. That rapport, not like the conventional delusion of that between twins, but rather such as might exist between 2 people who, regardless of sex or age or heritage of race or tongue, had been marooned at birth on a desert island. The island here, Sutphen's Hundred. The solitude, the shadow of that father, with whom not only the town but their mother's family as well had merely assumed armistice rather than accepting and assimilating. You see, there they are.